because I know that a lot of times we hear the story of Jacob. We see the action happening and unfolding in the narrative, and we examine it, and we're excited by it, and there's interesting parts of the story. But one of the things that really came out as I did this study for myself, the heart of what I'm trying to identify, and the thing that I really saw most clearly here, is this idea of the transformation that came as a result of Jacob's growing knowledge of who God was. So I think sometimes it's difficult for us to put ourselves in the place of the individual. What did Jacob know prior to his encounter with God? What did Jacob know of Yahweh God? What did he know of him? What was Jacob's exposure to God at this point? Up to the point where we encountered him when he's running from Esau after he's stolen the birthright and all that. What does he know of God? I'm going to drink coffee because you guys got to answer. Absolutely. That in Bethel. Yeah, while he was running in Bethel, he had a rock for a pillow and watched the angels ascending and descending from heaven. So he has what his dad has told him, right? Which we're not sure how much that was. There's really no clear indication of how much of that his father indicated. One thing I will say is, what was the blessing that Abraham gave, or that Isaac gave to him? It was fairly substantially tied to the Abrahamic covenant, right? So clearly, to some degree, and we even talked about this last week, to some degree, Jacob understood the material aspect of that promise from God. His father had at least instilled in him a desire to have that, right? If there was no spiritual instruction whatsoever, if he had no concept of Yahweh and no real desire to know him more, he wouldn't have pursued that so intensely. But the fact that he recognized, no, my father's being blessed by God by Yahweh, because of the fact that he's in this descendancy from Abraham. So that's an important thing to want. So he did have some knowledge of God, although it does seem, and I think the narrative that we've read bears out this idea, it does seem to some degree that his knowledge of God was primarily tied to what he could get out of the deal. Is that a fair assessment of where Jacob was at when we first met him? What can I get out of God? That seems to be where he's at. And I would say this, that in fact, I don't find that very unusual, even and especially in, let's call them, those that have first encountered or are beginning to discover the gospel. It kind of starts there to some degree. What can I get out of this? And that's the question that we often answer. Many times, and I'm trying to step away from this, but in my past, a lot of times I would start the testimony of the gospel by telling them, you don't want to die and go to hell, wouldn't you rather go to heaven? And that seems to be kind of where we tend to go with the gospel initially. And I'm not saying that's wrong, because it's absolutely true. But I think that that's where, if you get stuck there, you can kind of end up where Jacob's at to some degree. What do I get out of this deal? Well, okay, fine, I get to go to heaven when I die, which is important. I don't have to go to hell, which is also important, because I don't want to go there. And plus, you also add to it what we see a lot nowadays with this health and wealth gospel that says, hey, claim the promises of God. Name it and claim it. He said he's going to do this stuff. He has to do it. So as long as you say, God, you said this, and I am claiming that promise, and now you're forced into it. I'm twisting your arm into blessing and providing for me. And as long as you really believe it, well, then he's obligated himself to do it. So there you go. You're good to go. And I think that that's a misunderstanding as well of what it means to be in relationship to God. To be drawing near to God does not have that as its prime motivation. And so one of the things that I identify as we look at this and this life and as we examine his life before and after, I see Jacob before, what can I get out of the deal? And Jacob after, what has God done? There's this degree to which you recognize he sees God in a whole new light. After he encounters God in this environment, he sees God in a way that he will never be the same. God changes his name. God changes his purpose. He changes some of his foundational character. God transforms Jacob as a result of this encounter. And I think that's what we need to be pursuing. So what could another thing, what is another way of describing this growth from God, what can I get from you, to God, you're amazing and worthy of praise, and I want to have a relationship with you. What is that growth? Disciplined. Okay, so the discipline creates that growth. Absolutely. And you see that with Jacob. Clearly, God is saying, look, I need you to be here, but you're not here. you're here, and so I'm going to move you. And as I move you, I'm going to set up boundaries. Remember, we talked about this even last week, how as a result of this relationship with Laban, God creates a back fence. You can't get past this now. And it was your own doing, Jacob. You made the covenant that says, I will not go back to Laban, even though that's where you ran in the first place. You were running from Esau to Laban. Now you're running from your problem, Laban, into the arms of Esau. I've got you hemmed in on both sides. You've got to decide, who am I really? So God is bringing in the wall, so to speak, on Jacob. As a result of discipline and conflict and trial and crisis, he's pulling it all in so that he can put Jacob exactly where he needs him. But this process of moving from that knowledge of God that is primarily benefiting me to a knowledge of God where I am longing to glorify God, what is that process called? It still happens today, consequently. So don't think that I'm just thinking in terms of the narrative. What is that called? When we move as a believer from God, what do I get? To God, how can I glorify? Progressive sanctification. Spiritual maturity. Exactly right. He's maturing. He's coming to grips with, this is more than just what I get out of the deal. Look at a child, right? Look at a little kid. When they first come into the family, what is their needs? I need what I need. And what do they provide for you as an infant? Maybe a paperweight if you need to set something underneath them. I don't know. There's not a whole lot else that you can really use that for. They are entirely need. They need you. And that's all that they know is that you provide for me. But as they grow, what is our hope with our children? As we develop and as they grow in maturity, they begin to recognize that I can give. I can provide. How are you helping the family? How are you encouraging people? How are you uplifting us? What is it exactly that you are doing in this process? And they recognize as they grow and mature that there's more to my life than just what I can get out of it. And God's bringing us through that same process as he draws us near to him. He's saying, you're not just here. Our relationship is not just about what you can get from me. Our relationship is so much more. I want to glorify myself through you. And it requires a willingness on your part to draw near. That's one of the things that I recognize in Jacob. So let's remind ourselves. Oops. Wow, this is fantastic. Let's remind ourselves of where we're looking primarily. The tipping point of this narrative is in Genesis 32, verse 28. Then he said, your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. God transforms Jacob. He completely wipes what was before away and replaces it with something new in terms of his name. But there's something I'm going to identify about that in just a second here. But before we do that, let's remind ourselves where we were looking. So we started our narrative in Genesis chapter 30, and we saw Jacob in that moment where he is trying his best to make the most of a very uncomfortable, unpleasant situation. He's with his uncle Laban. He is trying his hardest to, first off, win Rachel, but then he ends up with Leah. So he has to win Rachel a second time and work for Laban. Laban adjusts his wages during that period, and then after that he wants to provide for his family. And we encounter that story where Laban tries to manipulate, deceive, supplant Jacob. He tries to use all of Jacob's tricks against him. And the two of them are in this intellectual and husbandry chess match where they're trying to get the better of the other individual. And at the end of those 6 years, so after 20 years of working, Jacob finally comes to the conclusion that he needs to leave. So he has an uncomfortable conversation with his wives and says, it's time to go. This situation is not going to get better. It's getting worse. We cannot stay. We have to leave. And he ties that to a conversation that he had with God as well. In addition to the fact that he recognized in his own experience, as he looks at the situation, things are getting bad and worse. I think the time is now. And God comes to him and says, I'm taking you. Remember, 20 years ago in Bethel, I met with you and told you I would protect you, I would provide for you, I would bless you, and I would bring you back across to the promised land again. Now's the moment. So he has this conversation with his wives, and they decide that they're going to sneak away while Laban is out shearing his sheep. Well, that naturally leads to something that's very uncomfortable. It's an unfortunate conflict where Laban is told that Jacob has taken all of his possessions and his wives and his children and all of the things that he has, and he's attempting to get out of town before Laban can figure out what's happening. And so Laban spends a few days, gets together all of the elders of their clan, and he goes chasing after Jacob. And he finally catches up with Jacob near Jabbok, and they have this really uncomfortable conversation where they basically come to grips with the whole reality. I kind of get the impression a little bit that There's a lot of stuff that had been unsaid up to this point. Jacob, both Jacob and Laban were trying to deceive the other. And on the surface, you've seen these relationships before, where there's the smiles, the pleasantries, the, oh, how are you, son? How's the flock doing? Oh, it's doing great, father-in-law, wonderful, how's the family? You could kind of sense that there wasn't a lot. They both knew the other was trying to sneak and take advantage of each other. And they finally get to this place where Laban and all of the kinsmen have rode up into Jacob's camp, and it's finally time for conflict, and it all comes spilling out. All of this conflict, all of this discord and disagreement. Jacob says, what are you doing? Laban, you have been nothing but conniving and sneaking and wicked in our relationship. And Jacob presents this glowing report of his own relationship with regard to Laban, which he had followed the letter of the law. He had legally met his obligations, but he had definitely done nothing to help the situation himself. They were both trying to posture each other as the wicked, evil deceiver, while I'm the harmed victim. I'm the wounded victim. And they're both trying to work this argument, this debate magic on each other to make it so that they were the ones that were wrong. But in the end, they kind of come to an impasse where Laban is unconvinced. He says, look, you did wrong. This is mine, which we identified last week, that his expression of all of you, your flocks, your herds, and all of these things, they belong to me. He was degrading the relationship that he had with Jacob to an unrepairable level. He says, you are my slave, essentially, is what he said. You have no business leaving. And Jacob said, that's it. And together they draw this line in the sand where they say, I will not cross over into your neck of the woods. You won't come to mine. At this point, they sever the relationship entirely. And that was part of that accusation that's made on by Laban. You stole my gods. That was a very interesting part of that conversation. During this period of time, as we move from the unpleasant backstory all the way into where we found it last week, you see this growth in Jacob, where he begins to understand more clearly what it is that he's dealing with. As he encounters God, and remember, we identified the fact that up to this point, God has been distant, so to speak, from Jacob. God came to Jacob as he was running from Esau initially and said, let me reveal myself to you. And he had this Jacob's ladder scenario, where he sees the angels, and he begins to understand that. But that was it, as far as it's recorded in terms of what we have. It doesn't appear that there was other relational or conversational type situations between God and Jacob. And Jacob just went about his business. But as you see this progression developing, you recognize that God is bringing these boundaries in on Jacob. He's hemming him in from both sides so that he's going to place Jacob in a spot where he has to make a decision about what he believes about God. And then you have that dramatic conclusion, which we've talked about, the fact that they made this agreement. And that ends chapter 31. Then starting in chapter 32, and we started looking at this last week, Jacob is now at a spot where he feels that relief, right? Oh, I'm finally free of this ridiculous 20-year arrangement with a conniving, wicked uncle who is taking advantage of me at every turn. Finally, I'm free. And he's beginning to look around at his possessions, and he's thinking, wow, we can maybe make a go of this. I can actually become my own boss. I'm so relieved. But then he remembers, I just jumped out of the frying pan into the fire, because where I was in a situation with Laban, which was difficult and uncomfortable and awkward and very frustrating, now I'm facing an even more serious situation. Laban argued that he could have hurt Jacob, but he wouldn't. Why wouldn't Laban have hurt Jacob? He says, I could have done you harm. Why wouldn't he have? Two reasons. The first reason was God said, you better not. He says, don't you even say anything bad. I don't want you to touch him. I don't want you to say good or bad. I want you to say nothing, right? Basically is what he said. Don't even curse him or anything. But what was the second reason why Laban probably wouldn't have hurt Jacob? He's his good luck charm, man. Every time Jacob touches something, it turns to gold. And even though Laban's mad because he sees, man, I could be so much more wealthy. Yeah, I am fairly well off now as a result of Jacob's hand, but his flocks combined with my flocks triples my wealth. So he, in his mind, he already was wealthy, and it was a direct result of Jacob, which is why when Jacob first said, I'm going to leave, he's like, no, I beg of you, write your own paycheck. You tell me what you need and let's do it. I mean, at that point, it was pretty obvious that God or that Laban really wanted to hold on to Jacob. So he probably wouldn't have hurt him. So now Jacob has crossed this line. And where does he find himself at this point? Facing what? Somebody that will absolutely hurt him. Somebody that has no trouble running him through with a spear. Somebody that wants him dead and said as much. So So really, his situation before, as difficult as it was, it was kind of that slow, steady drip. You know the difference between terror, like that moment of terror, and fear, like the slow building fear? To a certain degree, I think here in Laban's camp, he had that slow, steady, annoying drip. And it finally came to a head, and he said, enough, I'm done. And he washes his hands of that situation and realizes terror. Because where I was before was hard. Where I am now is life-threatening. And so at that moment of terror, he prays to God. And he's wrestling with that past. He calls out to God in chapter 32, verses 9 to 21. And he does something pretty amazing. So let's go ahead and catch ourselves up to the narrative by going to chapter 32 of Genesis. And we're going to read starting in verse number 9. Genesis chapter 32, starting in verse number 9. Then Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, return to your country and to your relatives, I will prosper you. I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and of all the faithfulness which you have shown to your servant. For with my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother and from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he will come and attack me and the mothers with the children. For you said, I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sands of the sea, which is too great to be numbered. So he spent the night there. Then he selected from what he had with him a present for his brother Esau, 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milking cows with their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. He delivered them into the hand of his servants. They drove every drove by itself, and said to his servants, pass on before me, and put a space between droves. And he commanded the one in front, saying, when my brother Esau meets you and asks you, saying, to whom do you belong, and where are you going, and to whom do these animals in front of you belong, then you shall say, these belong to your servant Jacob. It is a present sent to my lord Esau, and behold, he also is behind us. Then he commanded unto the second and the third and all those who followed the droves, saying, after this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him. And you shall say, behold, your servant Jacob also is behind us. For he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me. Then afterward I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. So the present passed on before him while he himself spent the night in the camp. This is a very interesting section of scripture. I find this very fascinating, and it's especially in light of what we recognize about the character of Jacob, right? And this is so poetic. It's so vivid in my own imagination as I encounter this. Jacob has just got done praying. And remember, we identified the fact that Jacob's prayer was fantastic. His prayer was well spoken. It reflected a number of things. What did we identify about this prayer of Jacob's? What did we say about this prayer that was so amazing? Anybody recall from last week? What was so unique about this? I mean, just the prayer itself. Why is that such an amazing thing? Did anybody try to find any other places in the Old Testament where there's the individual initiating conversation with God? It's actually surprisingly difficult to find. You rarely find an individual praying and initiating the conversation. Most often, you see God coming to the individual. But in this case, Jacob is praying to God. So take note of that. It's pretty significant. I think that's interesting that you see that. Additionally, what else did we identify about this prayer? Do you remember his prayer? Where did it start? Where does that prayer start? Jacob said what? God of my father, Abraham and Isaac. Precisely. It starts where he basically prays the words of God back to him. He says, God, this is who you are. This is your character. God, you are the father. You are the God of my father, of Abraham and Isaac. I have history with you. I know who you are. This comes back to what I asked earlier. How much context did Jacob have of Yahweh? Not a whole lot outside of that relationship. I mean, what context do we have of God? We have the entire revealed word of God. We have the Spirit of God resting within us. And we also have those around us who can help explain and express each of our own individual relationships with God. We have a lot of resources to know this God. Jacob did not. He did not have a lot of commentaries on his shelf. Oh God, I recall from this commentary, this guy said that you were this way. All he had was his own experience. He said, God, you are the God that was with my fathers. And in addition, you were the God that said that you would bless my fathers. You were the one that revealed the fact that you were going to use my family to bless the nations, the Abrahamic covenant. That's all he knows of God. That's it. That's his kind of his whole concept of God. But notice what he does after that. Since you've got it there and since you've already got us started, Kevin, what comes after? He expresses the truth of what God says about himself in terms of the Abrahamic relationship. What comes next? When he starts talking about himself, what does he say? Do you see that? I am unworthy. I am unworthy. I am humble. God, I don't deserve your faithfulness and love. What is he recognizing at this point? He's already started to do this as you see him talking with Laban and with his wives. What's he beginning to recognize? God is the one prospering me. That is a monumental revelation to Jacob at this point. That blew his mind to pieces. I did not make this happen. My own ability, my own skill, my own passion at being a farmer is not what made me able to have this collection of stuff. God, this is you. This is directly as a result of your blessing. He began to see God for who he was. And when he recognized that, you see something from Jacob that you have never yet seen before, and that is humility. He says, God, I am unworthy of your love and of your faithfulness. That is a very key recollection. What is that related to the initial conversation? So he says, God of my fathers and of this covenant that you made with them, how does that differ from what he just said? What is that looking to? My relationship in regards to my family. That's my family's faith. That's my family's commitment to God. This is what you told my fathers. But when he brings it back to himself, he says, this is what I've experienced. I'm unworthy of your blessing. I have seen your hand. Uncle Laban was ready to do me harm, but he himself, as wicked and as terrible as he was, he himself had an encounter with God where God said, don't you touch him. God, Why are you sticking up for me? Why are you protecting me? God, you're amazing. And I'm unworthy. He's beginning to see God for himself, personally. He's beginning to encounter that Yahweh that he saw in Bethel. But it's beginning to mean something different and more to him. He is praying this very specific, very, very good prayer as he's expressing his fear before God. He prays God's words back to him. He's humble and honest about who God is. He's honest about himself and his own needs, and he's also thinking of others. That's the other thing we identified last week. He says, save me, deliver me, help. It's an honest, sincere prayer. It's not, I will try hard to make this work, God, but if I miss a few things, would you mind making up the slack? He's saying, God, help. I'm stuck, which is a very, very important place for Jacob to be, is stuck. When Jacob's stuck, God begins to get a hold of his heart. He says, Jacob, I can't have you running every time I try to discipline, train, mature, and grow you. So I am hemming you in. I am forcing you to stand still. And Jacob, you're beginning to recognize you need saving. You need help because you can't do this on your own. Your own skill, your own ambition, your own deceptive nature is not sufficient any longer. You need me. And you're saying so, honestly expressing, God, help me, because I'm stuck. That is a very good prayer. And it finishes with him thinking about others, which is a very unique thing for Jacob. When he says, not just me, but also the mothers with their children. I recognize and I see that there are others who need your help as well. I am not just my own. I came across this water with a stick. That's all I had. When I crossed this water, all I had was a staff. And that's free. I don't even have to pay for that. I could have had two because I could have picked the second one up, but I didn't even have two sticks. I just had one. And here I am. That's all I've got. And now you've brought me back across this river. And I now have my stick, which I've still got. And look what else I'm responsible for. I'm responsible for the servants. I'm responsible for these animals. I'm responsible for these goods. And most specifically, I'm responsible for the mothers and their children. There's one thing that really sticks out in that regard when he says, God, save me because Esau could kill me, and not just me, but the mothers and their children. What does that reflect about Jacob's relationship with his family? And anything in specific that you notice about that prayer? the one he's leading, the family he's leading. He's saying, protect these mothers and their children. He's finally thinking of them and not himself. How's his relationship with especially his two brides? Why not? He loves the one, Rachel, the one he really wanted. The name Rachel has been, it's the little U as opposed to Leah, which means wild cow. I mean, the thing, and that's actually, it's interesting when you start looking at the Hebrew, their names are almost hilarious in terms of how they related. He has two brides, which we've already established is a really bad plan. But apart from that, now he obviously favored Rachel. He loved her. He cared for her. And he still does. And to the end of his life, what happens? He still favors who? Benjamin and Joseph, the two sons of his favorite wife. But he is asking God's protection on more than just Rachel and Joseph. He's saying, the wives, the women, and their children. He's seeing a bigger picture here. He's beginning to recognize, and he's beginning to care for more than his own interests. Yeah, he may not love the wild cow, but he still wants her protected. Right? He still recognizes that these are my children. These, God, are part of my blessing, and I want you to provide and protect. He prays for them to be provided for. So that's a pretty astounding reality for him to go there. And then he continues after he prays, and this is really important. So he finishes his prayer, and what happens? Suddenly a pillar of fire appears on one side and a pillar of smoke on the other. And there's these flaming swords with angels that stand in front of him. And he thinks, oh, God, you're amazing. Thank you for rescuing me. Is that what happens? No. Does God even answer? Not that we see. Isn't that difficult? When you're in that environment, you finally are praying. You're like, okay, God, I'm being honest. I'm praying sincere, honest prayers. God, help. Save me. Okay. And he gets finished. What was his expectation? Who knows? I mean, up to this point, God has revealed that he's incredibly powerful, strong, capable, and loving in answering. So I would kind of envision in my own mind, he sort of gets up, dusts his hands off, looks around and says, all right, here we are. What now? I mean, I prayed, I did that, but what does he immediately do after he finishes praying? He starts making a plan. He is always Jacob. And I love that. If it were something where suddenly, after this encounter with God, he's like this holy, like, oh, everywhere he goes, he floats. I mean, that would be a different environment altogether. But after he finishes, he still is Jacob. And in his mind, he thinks, okay, I prayed. I prayed, God, you saw me pray. So obviously, I've left it in your hands. Now, this is what we're going to do. And he begins to plan this thing out. And what was his plan? It's a beautiful plan if you think about it. It's wonderful. Because in his mind, he thinks, okay, if we're, you know, strategically, as a general, you look at the situation, and if we're just a big clump of individuals where we've got animals that we're trying to protect, people that we're trying to protect, and I don't have any warriors here in this environment, we are going to get slaughtered. We are going to all die. However, if I string us out, and if I make it so that there's small groups, if one group gets attacked, the other group can split off. If that group gets attacked, then this group can split off. And so we can scatter very easily if I narrow things down to small pockets. So that's his first thought. And then his second thought is, I will try to appease my brother. I will try to convince him that I am the most loving, most gracious, most generous, most amazing brother that he's ever had. And I don't know if any of you have ever been in really big trouble with family members, but sometimes this is where your gut goes. You're like, and especially me, I have a tendency to kind of give. That's how I express love is I want to give you things. And so I have a tendency to, I just start to give you as much as possible so that you like me, right? And that's Jacob's mindset. He's like, okay, this is what I'll do. I will separate out from my group because they're going to probably die anyway if Jacob comes or if Esau comes and attacks us. I'm going to take this group of animals here and I'm going to send them out ahead. And it's just a small group, right? So the first thought that I have there is the small group of individuals with those servants, which by the way, if you're one of the servants that got assigned to that first group, you're like, what? Why me? What did I do? You know, you're the lead, you're on the front lines, away, away. And so you show up and the thing is a small group, it's much less intimidating for one thing, right? So they're probably not going to come out swords drawn. It's just this little group of sheep and a, like maybe a really terrified servant like behind it. You know, okay, well, here we go. A small little group shows up. They're probably going to be like, what are you doing? What are you doing out here? They're not going to immediately attack. They're going to ask questions. And they're supposed to tell Esau, I'm from your servant Jacob. He's your servant, by the way. He's not your master. Could he call himself master of Jacob or of Esau? Could he? Why? He got the birthright, right? He could call himself Esau's master because he took that family responsibility. But instead, he's saying, oh, just in case you remember back when I stole the blessing and the birthright, I'm going to pretend like that never happened. I'll actually be your servant. Let's plan it that way. Let's just pretend like I never did that. Let's say I'm your servant. And let's say all of these animals are yours. Let's just say that. And then shortly behind that, you have another group of animals. Same story. And again and again and again. I mean, that's pretty astounding. You're just lathering the butter on this guy. You're buttering him up until there's no bread left. This guy is going to try to convince Esau to not attack him, to save him and protect him. So he goes about this wonderfully thought out plan to try to convince Esau that everything is fine, everything is good, and there's no reason to be angry with him any longer. And that leaves him in a very interesting position, right? So he divests himself of a lot of stuff, and then what's left, he takes the remaining amount and he divides them into two groups, one with Leah and one with Rachel. And by the way, when we actually see this starting, I think, in chapter 33, verse 1, the last people to come is Rachel and Joseph. They are at the end of the line. Because if he still is angry and still is going to kill his way through all of this, the last thing that he wants to lose is Rachel and Joseph. So it's not that he's not who he was before. He still is Jacob in terms of his relationship with his bride. But he's starting to see the picture. But at this point, you know, he's left. And what happens when all of this stuff goes out? Every time a group leaves, it gets a little smaller. And a little smaller. And a little smaller. And we don't know how much he had exactly. But in my mind, I see by the time he sent all of these gifts off, I mean, you're trying to fight for your life. How much are you willing to give away for the sake of your own safety and your life? Pretty much all of it, I would think. So in my mind, he doesn't have a whole lot left in terms of his own possessions. Because that's the other thing. If he shows up and he's like, yeah, I just gave you a pittance, you know, brother, I could do away with 20. I could give you 3,000 animals and I still have 80 million. No big deal. I don't see that. I would rather, in my mind, I see him, and maybe it's because I have the car salesman in me still, but maybe I see in his own, he's giving more to his brother than he keeps for himself, right? Wouldn't you assume that's the case? I'm going to give him more so that it's like, wow, you're even giving me more than what you saved back. So he's left with a much smaller company than he started with. And then he takes that and he divides that, and then he himself crosses the river. And when he crosses the river Jabbok, he's left alone, back where he started. He has done what he knew to do, and now he's stuck wrestling with the past. Still in that moment where he's fearful. It's nighttime. That is one of the things that God seems to do quite frequently. Have you noticed how often God comes in the evening? Have you noticed that in Scripture? How often God comes in the evening? Why is that? Do you suppose? Why is it that God seems to favor coming in the evening to speak with his children? I mean, in the cool of the day, the first relationship that he had with Adam and Eve, in the cool of the eve he came. Why do you suppose that is? Any ideas? Mm-hmm. You're done working. You're quiet. You're still, right? The world around you is silent, and you're resting. God created rest. And in that moment, he says, I want to fellowship with you in this. You're quiet. You're finally done with all your plans, done with all your maneuvers. If God would have tried to come to Jacob when he's dividing up all of these groups, Jacob would have been so busy. His mind would have been running a million miles an hour, getting everything ready, tying the bows on the presents and sending them off. I mean, at that point, he needed Jacob to be quiet before he finally comes to Jacob to talk with him. He plans. He schemes to try to find a way to protect what's most valuable to him. But God finally gets Jacob alone, so he is left with exactly where he started. And we see that from verse 21 to 24. Let's read that quickly together here. Now he arose the same night and took his two wives and his two maids and his 11 children and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. And he took them and sent them across the stream and he sent across whatever he had. Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. I find that astounding. All right? He finally has whatever's left with him. All he's got is his two wives, his girlfriends, and the sons and daughters that are born by them. And he says, I'm going to take you. I'm going to send you across the river, which is a strategic move as well. I'm going to make sure that there's a body of water standing between you and potential death. And that leaves him alone, finally alone. And he's camping by himself in this probably in my mind, I see kind of like the shaded nook there by the river. And he is terrified. And he's going through his mind, what could I have done differently? What should I have done differently? And perhaps he's looking out to the distance as the dust is settling from the last group of animals that he sent out ahead of him. Or maybe they've already made camp in varying spots and he can perhaps look down and see all the fires as they go off into the distance of all of these different presents and groups. And he's wringing his hands in his tent. And he's thinking, what have I done? Is this enough? Have I protected enough? Have I thought enough? Have I missed anything? And then there is the most understated verse in my mind in all of history. It's kind of like saying somebody jumped over a fence and was almost electrocuted. It's this sense of, there's got to be more to that story. There's got to be more than what I heard, because it says a man came and wrestled with him till daybreak. What? Do what now? I'm sorry, excuse me, what the, rewind the tape. What did you just say happened? That is astounding. Jacob is by himself, which, by the way, if you're already jumpy and afraid, and you're by yourself, you're not going to get much sleep that night, and then suddenly what happens? A man appears. All right? And so in your mind you're thinking, well, who is this? And so this is where I start filling in the blanks in my own imagination. I start building this story. Jacob's there. He's waiting anxiously. You know, it's later and later. Maybe it's, you know, getting close to the middle of the night, and he's thinking, okay, well, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. I'm sure it'll work. And then all of a sudden he hears a crunch outside the tent. Who's there? Right? No answer. So he goes and he kind of, you know, you've been out camping before. You're like, what is that? And you're listening. Is it a bear? You know, listening for the snort. I can't hear it. And then you hear another crunch. That's not just an accident. That's not just like a squirrel throwing acorns. This is serious business. And you know, he unzips the tent a little and he peeks out and there's a guy out there. Who are you? No answer. There doesn't appear like there's any response from this man, because we don't know. But in my mind, you know, all of a sudden he says, well, what are you doing here? Who are you? Are you with Esau? What's he expecting? Death. He's expecting to die. So he's immediately on the defensive. Who are you with? Are you part of my party? Did you sneak around? Did Esau send out an assassin to get me so that he doesn't have to go to the trouble of killing all of the rest of us? And so but it's dim enough that he can't see. And suddenly this guy, as he gets near, the guy starts wrestling with him. He just like pushes him down and starts to wrestle with Jacob. I mean, at that point, you're convinced. If you were worried before that this guy might be an unfriendly, now you're convinced of it. This guy is wrestling with me. And in my mind, I see this, you know, there's this battle that ensues. And they begin to wrestle with each other. Now, how old is Jacob? Anybody remember? We talked about this once or twice before. How old is Jacob at this point? Suffice it to say, he's no spring chicken. He was probably about 70, give or take. So this is not just like, in my mind, I see a young, strapping young guy, like they're wrestling together. I don't think that was it at all. Jacob, he's old. And this guy begins to wrestle with Jacob. I don't envision that Jacob is like, well, I knew that judo training would come in handy someday and he's doing all these moves and stuff. I think he probably would wrestle a lot like I would wrestle. A guy that has no clue, who really doesn't know what he's doing, and he's just really more than anything hanging on, right? And in fact, when you see the narrative developed even further, more than anything what you see is that he's just trying not to die. It's not like he's trying to necessarily like get the better of him. He's just trying not to let this guy reach for whatever weapon he brought with him. And so he is hanging on for dear life with this character as he's wrestling in the dark. And there's scuffling and there's grunting and there's sweat and there's biting and pinching and pushing, and it's all happening in this tent. And it goes on and it goes on and it goes on. And you wonder in your mind, what is it that is going on? What exactly is happening? So they're wrestling all night long. Starting in verse number 24 through 27. Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh. So the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for the dawn is breaking." But he said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he had said to him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. This is astounding. He's wrestling with this. You have in your mind this imagination. He wrestles till daybreak. That is a long wrestling match. When we leave him, he sent his families across the river. He's waiting for daybreak himself. Was it 1 a.m? Who knows? 2? Who knows? Somewhere in the middle of the night, he begins to wrestle. And they wrestle and wrestle and wrestle and wrestle and wrestle. And finally, at the moment when the dawn is beginning to twinge the sky, you could just barely see the colors. Suddenly, for the first time, this man speaks and says, "Let me go, for daylight is here." And Jacob responds with something that is very significant. What does he say? "Not unless you bless me." So what has happened in the middle of the night? What has happened from the moment that he began to wrestle with this man and daybreak? He's recognized he's not wrestling any old ordinary guy. This is not some assassin from Esau. You wouldn't ask an assassin from Esau to bless you. He has come to grips with, this is God that I'm wrestling with. Somewhere between that moment when he started wrestling and this point in time, he has recognized, I am wrestling with God. And he asks for a blessing from this man. Now, when we talk about wrestling with a man, it's constantly referred to as man. But then we recognize that this individual blesses him and has the authority of God. In my estimation, we're looking at another Christophany. What is a Christophany? Remind me. A pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. Because remember, we went back to verses that says the image of God is best seen through Christ. If you want to know what God looks like, you've been given Christ. Every time you see God, the representation of God is in Christ. And in my estimation, this is Christ. He is wrestling with Christ at this point. He is wrestling with God. And he is trying as best he could to get the upper hand. And it is impossible. Jacob discovers that the man is really God himself. I think it's a Christophany. If that is the case, why couldn't the man beat Jacob? If this is really God, why couldn't the man beat Jacob? Well, that's a silly question to ask. He could, right? Could he have beaten Jacob? Have you ever wondered that? I looked at this the first time back when I was a kid, and it talked about Jacob wrestling with God, and I thought, that's dumb. God could totally beat him. Right? I mean, really, honestly, there's no reason why God couldn't. So if that's the case, why did he let him wrestle till daybreak? Right, absolutely. But could God have made him let him go? Absolutely. So, whose will was it for him to wrestle? Jacob's or God's? It was God's. It wasn't Jacob's will, so to speak, that was keeping this fight going. It was God's longing. It wasn't that God was saying, I don't want to bless you. I don't want to. Stop. Leave me alone. Help. It wasn't that at all. Instead, what was going on is God was saying, Jacob, I long to bless you. I will stay and I will fight through with you because you need blessing. God was not trying to not bless Jacob. God was longing to bless Jacob, but Jacob had to come to the end of his own strength before he recognized God for who he was. And he realized, I can't fix the problem. I can't do this on my own. I need deliverance from God. I need a blessing from God. God absolutely could have. And in fact, so much so, how do we know that God could have beat him at any point? Because he did. What did he do? He touches the socket. Just and pop, it's out. That sounds painful. Is that painful? Is it hurt from your estimation? You're squinting like it would. Pops out, yeah. You know, the whole idea of a dislocated, you dislocate stuff all the time, Cameron. Does it hurt? A little bit? Yeah, a little bit. I mean, that's excruciating. Why is it that God touched his thigh? In my estimation, I think the reason God touched his thigh is because it's the largest muscle. This is the seat of your strength. This is the biggest strength you've got left. I touch it, and you're instantly disabled. Excruciating as he cries out in pain. He's left maimed, right? God pops his thigh out. And yet in that moment, God has demonstrated, at any point in this fight, I could have beat you. But you needed to understand that about me. You need to recognize that I am sovereign and I'm in charge. The man wrestled all night to demonstrate to Jacob that no matter how much strength Jacob had, he was no match for God. In my mind, I kind of see this, and I know I often see these illustrations. We were out riding horses with the Leonards earlier last week, I think on Monday. And Nathaniel just was full of that little boy, like, everywhere he was going, he was growling. And so I thought, well, it's time, you know, he needs a release here at this point, or else he's going to freak the horses out and someone's going to get kicked. And so I said, all right, come on, come on. And he's like, you know, it was really cool. He didn't do that. But, you know, and he comes at me and he's like, and he's swinging. And I'm like, you know, hitting him on the side of the head and keeping him down. And then all of a sudden I grab him and I throw him on the ground, not throw him, push him down on the ground. He's like, and he gets back up and he comes at me again, you know, and I pick him up and I flip him over and I set him back down and I step back here. He thinks he's going to beat me. Well, could I have beat him at any point? Well, of course I could, but I don't want to. He's my son. I enjoy wrestling with him. I love watching that little boy in him strong and I can get you, daddy. In my estimation, I think that's kind of how it went for God to some degree. He's wrestling with his son and he's showing his son, I'm powerful, I'm strong, I could beat you, but I don't want to. I love you. I care for you. And so at that moment, when Jacob's thigh is dislocated or his hip socket is dislocated, God demonstrates that he could at any point win. Take the battle. It's the largest, strongest muscle of the body. By touching his thigh, the man was deliberately crippling Jacob. Deliberately crippling him to the point, or at the point of his greatest strength. This man was deliberately crippling Jacob at the point of his greatest strength. When we wrestle with God, I think many times we come to that spot where God deliberately attacks our greatest human strength. What is your biggest source of confidence? What is your biggest source of self-reliance? What is your biggest physical, human, so to speak, muscle that you depend on? When God wants to encounter you, when he wants to draw near to you, he will interact with that thing that you feel is your best and strongest asset. And he'll say, give me that. We're so willing to give God all these other things. God, you can take this, you can take that, you can take the other. But this thing over here that's my best thing, my treasure, the thing that I love the most, my strongest point, you can't have that, God. And God says, that's what I want. That's where you come to recognize that I am the one who is doing this work, not you. God takes from Jacob his biggest source of strength. And it seems unfair. Why would God do that? Why would God play that game? Doesn't that seem unfair at the beginning? He's finally like, boom, touches his hip and it pops out. That's dirty. You can't fight that way. That's uncalled for. What is it demonstrating? It's demonstrating the result of this wrestling. What happened as a result of it? Let's finish this off in 28 through 32. And he said, so he asked him the question, what is your name? I want to point this one thing out here, and I know we're running short on time, so I'm going to move quickly. The one thing that I noticed so significant is God asks him a very important question. After he asks for the blessing, he says, what is your name? Has that question been asked of Jacob before? It has. You know who asked him? His father. And what did he say?
Esau.
And at this point, Jacob is honest. I'm Jacob. I'm supplanter. I'm grabber. I'm stealer. I'm deceiver. He was honest about who he was. Finally, he is honest about who he is to God. He says, I am Jacob. I am the one who has taken advantage of people. I am the one who has depended on my own strength and my own cunning to get the upper hand. And God asks him a question, and Jacob answers honestly, I am Jacob. And he said, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. Then Jacob said to him, Jacob asked him and said, please tell me your name. But he said, why is it that you ask my name? And he blessed him there. So Jacob named the place Peniel, for he had said, I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved. Now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Peniel. And he was limping on his thigh. Therefore, to this day, the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip, which is on the socket of the thigh, because they touched the socket of Jacob's thigh and the sinew of his hip. This is the result of that wrestling. Jacob's honest. And God changes his name from Jacob to Israel. And Israel, by the way, it means I have prevailed with God and won. But it's an interesting word there, this idea of Israel, because it doesn't, if you actually read it literally, it doesn't mean Jacob has prevailed against God, but actually that God has prevailed against Jacob. If you read it, it can mean both, but it seems to, in the original form, mean more that God wrestled with Jacob and won. So the question becomes, who really won? Who really won this battle? The Hebrew text has the wordplay, one who prevails with God, but literally means the opposite, God who prevails with man. Jacob had not struggled with God and won, but God had struggled with Jacob and won. How is that possible? Is that really what happened? Who won? Who won the fight? God did, didn't he? Come on. You know God won the fight. His hip was out of joint. He was left lame. God won the fight. But who really won the fight? Jacob. Why is that? Why is it that we could say that God won the fight, yet Jacob won the fight? That's the heart of what I see here. Who won the match that night? God. Who lost? Jacob. But really, who won? Jacob. That's the paradox of life. When we wrestle with God, we always lose. But when we lose, we win. Jesus reminds us over and over again. Mark 8:35. Whoever wants to save his life will lose it. Whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant in Matthew 20:26. Whoever wants to be first must be your slave, Matthew 20:27. God, when we lose, we win. That was the message that was presented at this point. When Jacob finally gave up and lost, he was ready to win. Because now, God had complete control over Jacob. God owned Jacob in every way. That is what happened. Jacob won. That's the heart of the gospel, right? Is that not the heart of the gospel? That's the heart of what we say when we talk about the fact that not by my own good works could I save myself, but according to his mercy, I have to lose. I have to let go of my own strength and ability and let God be the one that gets the victory. That is the whole point of the relationship that God has with us. Is that he will glorify himself through our lives if we are willing to surrender to him, to give up and lose, and finally come to the end of our own strength and ability and intellect and say, God, you and you only can save me. You and you only can get the victory, and I am willing to lose so I can finally win. That is the heart of this argument. That is the heart of this fight. And that was what changed fundamentally after Jacob encountered God. Is he was finally willing to lose. Finally willing to give up his own ability, his own strength. The last shall be first, the first shall be last. That's the message here. So there's a lesson that we learn from this encounter. The first lesson that I pull away, God brings us again and again to crisis points where our persistent self-sufficiency is shattered and we are forced to yield ourselves to God in an entirely new way. That is what God wants to do in our life. That is the process of maturity. Do you understand that's what we're called to? You want to know what the Christian life is about? It's coming again and again to this point where my own persistent sufficiency is destroyed. And I recognize once again, God, you're sovereign and in charge. I am not enough to fight you. Until we are broken by God, we can never be greatly used by God. This is an idea that came first from Spurgeon. He used this idea where until we are broken and until God changes us and shatters us, we cannot be fully used by him. God uses broken men. I have a book that's called Leading with a Limp. It's built from this same concept. Until I can come to the place where I am broken by God, true leadership is impossible. True spiritual development is impossible. Without that, until God breaks us, he can't use us. And until we admit the truth about our condition, our name, so to speak, we will remain as we are. God asked Jacob a very specific question. What is your name? What is your essential character, Jacob? And until you come to that place where you're honest about that, and until you can come to the spot where you say, God, I am weak. I am wicked. I am supplanter. I am self-sufficient. I am prideful. I am fearful. Until you can be honest about your condition, God won't, you can't grow past that. God needs you to come to that spot. That is where we find Jacob at this point, as he's finally honest about who he was. And finally, once God breaks us, we will look back on that experience with gratitude. The next morning, Jacob limps. And for the rest of his life, he limps, but Jacob doesn't complain. Why? Because that limp is a reflection of a new reality for him. I have wrestled with God and won. And yet I lost, but I won. And this is an eternal symbol, a sign of the fact that I am weak, but God is strong. God has given me that. Many, many things. I have scars in my body that God has given me where I was wrestling with God for certain things. I wanted control over my future, and I ended up with a scar from where they pulled out a septic appendix. I wanted control over my family, and God left me with a scar. I have scars, and those scars, they mean something to me in a different way than I thought they would. They are representative of the fact that God has done something in my life, and it's God who did it. If you want the stories, I can tell you, there's no question. This was God intervening, stepping into the moment and saying, quiet, I'm gonna put you out flat on a hospital bed for 5 days until you finally shut up and listen to what I want to tell you. And I'm going to leave you with a permanent symbol or scar of the fact that I own you. Your life is mine. We need those. We have to have those because when we look back on that, I don't look back on that with terror. I look back on my struggle with God with gratitude because it means God loved me enough to step into my life and change me and transform me and grow me and develop me. That is the result of this encounter with God. And that's the heart of this passage. These are the lessons that I see there. And the question becomes, how much of this has occurred in your life? How much are you willing to embrace this reality? As you live out this Christian growth, this progressive sanctification, this moving forward into Christian maturity, are you willing to wrestle with yourself and your self-reliance and to be crushed by God so that He can get glory? That's the question that's confronting us from this encounter. God, thank you so much. Lord, for the privilege that we have of seeing you interact with Jacob. Lord, it's astounding to see how you intervene in this situation, how you hem him in, force him to silence, and then wrestle with him to show that you are strong and that you are enough. Lord, I pray that you'll help each of us to see ourselves in this narrative. To find our own desires and wills, Lord, so passionately avoiding surrender. Lord, I pray that you'll help us to be willing to be broken, to wrestle with you, Lord, and with ourselves and our own tendencies and our own ambitions, and to come out on the other side recognizing that you are all-sufficient and all-powerful and worth giving up to, Lord. I just pray that you will help us. Lord, I pray that our church will be characterized by individuals who are not leaning on their own self-sufficiency, leaning on their own conniving or intellect or any of those things, but instead, Lord, we will be a family, a church body that is completely absorbed in longing to know you in the way that Jacob knew you. Lord, I pray that you will bless us for your glory and for your name's sake. And it's in your name that we pray all these things. Amen. Let's stand together and let's sing in closing.